ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit LeggMason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Connor will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, nice show this week. As always, I want to thank the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime, Legg Mason. One of the most popular segments of the ETF market so far this year is low or minimum volatility ETFs. Even though U.S. stocks are up 15 to 16%, there have been a few bumps along the way. And May in particular was pretty rocky, with the market dropping about 6%. And I think with this ongoing trade war and investors trying to figure out what the Fed might do next, and some concern that perhaps we're late in this market cycle, right, that this bull market can't go on forever, some investors are getting a bit more defensive. And low volatility ETFs can make sense here because they offer exposure to the stock market, but attempt to do so with lower risk, really offer an overall smoother ride. In just a moment, we're going to look at this area of ETFs with ETF.com's Drew Voris. We'll highlight the two most popular lower minimum volatility ETFs, and we'll also have Drew provide some context around the amount of money flowing into these ETFs right now. And then later, we're going to spotlight another ETF fitting into this category, the Vol Shares Large Cap ETF. This looks at shorter-term measures of volatility and attempts to put together a basket of stocks from the S&P 500 that is more stable overall. Dom Catrimbone, CEO of Whitford Asset Management, who's behind this ETF, will walk us through that one. And besides the ETF itself, I'm really looking forward to this conversation because Dom has a unique perspective on just how competitive the ETF space is. He's lived it this year, perhaps more than any other issuer. I think you're going to find his story pretty interesting. Also joining us this week will be Tobias Carlisle, founder and managing director of Acquirers Funds. They recently launched their first ETF. It's appropriately called the Acquirers Fund. It's based on a metric Tobias developed called the Acquirers Multiple. Tobias actually wrote a book on this. Essentially, it's the same value metric buyout firms use to find potential acquisitions. So if you think about a firm who's in the business of buying companies, of course, they don't want to overpay for those companies, right? They want to get the best deal they can and buy companies who appear significantly undervalued. Connor, basically, Tobias has taken this concept and wrapped it into an ETF.
Yeah, this is going to be a great conversation with Tobias. His new ETF is probably easiest described as being a deep value fund. And, you know, the value has been an interesting area over the past several years and got a lot of attention because of the drastic underperformance compared to growth funds or just the general market over the past several years. And there's been a lot of talk about how value should be measured today in today's economy. You know, for the past several decades, if not longer, you know, price to book value, the underlying value of your assets as a firm, those metrics seem to work well in a manufacturing-based economy. But that is not where the United States is today. And the real question is, and I'm going to be very interested to see Tobias's thoughts on this, is how do you measure value in today's economy? Because a lot of these older metrics, again, like price to book value, seem to be dead. They don't seem to be working appropriately in today's service-based economy. So it's going to be a really fun conversation with Tobias.
Yeah, the issue is the balance sheet's not capturing things like intellectual property, right? Your brand value, those sorts of things that matter much more in a service-based economy. And by the way, that ETF has a great ticker symbol, ZIG, Z-I-G. So it should be a good conversation. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com or you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci. Also, if you enjoy ETF Prime, we would greatly appreciate it if you could leave us a quick review on Apple Podcasts. All right, let's start this week with ETF.com's Drew Voris.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s.
For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Drew, first, give us a sense as to the amount of money flowing into lower minimum volatility ETFs right now. What do those flows look like so far this year?
Well, thanks, Nate, and hi, Connor. Always appreciate being on. I want to start probably with a 30,000-foot look at flows. As you guys both mentioned, there has been a risk aversion from investors. So, for instance, fixed income has taken in $42 billion for the year. And as you mentioned, or we've talked about before, equity has taken in approximately $14 billion in new inflows as of the end of May. And to break that down even a little bit further before we get into the low vol, SPY, that's, the biggest ETF in the world, S&P 500 SPY Trust, has seen $14 billion. In outflows, although it is a $260 billion fund that doesn't move the meter a whole lot. But so flows, when you start slicing and dicing and trying to put them together like a puzzle, sometimes can be difficult. But certainly, we have seen some positive flows go into the low-risk equity portion of the market beyond fixed income. And the two funds that we're referring to are the iShares Edge MSCI Minimal Vol USA ETF, USMV. It has about $28 billion in assets, and the Invesco S&P 500 Low Volatility ETF, SPLV, has about $13 billion. There's also some 25 other low-vol ETFs, but these two have taken in, USMV has taken in some $5 billion in new flows. SPLV has taken in over $2 billion. So that's half of what we've seen in new flows go into equity ETFs. That doesn't mean that all the money that left SPY went into these, but there's obviously a theme of pulling back on equities, going into risk aversion type of products, and that's what we're seeing right now.
Drew, you mentioned risk aversion. Do you think the rationale for these flows is that straightforward? Just that we're seeing some risk aversion with a trade war. Perhaps investors are becoming concerned over slowing economic growth globally. Maybe we're a bit late in this bull market. Do you think it's that simple?
I do. I really do. And the other thing, too, we're seeing it in, if we want to break down these two funds, SPLV is the least, basically takes the least volatile stocks, a 100 in the S&P period. That's what they do. USMV considers stock correlation and poses sector constraints. So it's a little bit different between low vol, which is straightforward, and minimal vol that takes in some extra factors. But what we're seeing is a concentration into utilities, healthcare. I mean, those are safe sectors. You know, financials or particularly energy has been a rough sector lately, and that's a big portion of the market. So we're seeing sort of these individual stocks in these sectors being bought up, not necessarily just by ETFs, but by individual active managers, institutions, et cetera. So there's definitely a shift into the safer sectors, and then those individual holdings in those sectors are seeing a little price valuation. And both these two low vol ETFs are designed not to capture upside. They're designed to protect you on the downside. But however, both are outperforming the S&P 500 right now. And I think that more than ETF flows, I think it's just investor demand for these kind of safer individual stocks that end up being in the buckets of these ETFs.
Yeah, and to your point on performance, I looked as of this past Friday, the S&P 500 is up about 16%, while USMV, so the iShares Edge, MSCI, Minvol, USA ETF, that's up 18%. And then SPLV, so the S&P 500 low volatility ETF from Invesco, that's up 20%. And then also there's been significant outperformance over the trailing 1 year. So the S&P 500 is up about 6%. SPLV is up 20% and USMV is up 17%. I think the gap really widened in the fourth quarter of last year, but that's a big difference. Now, we always say don't time factors, right? Whether it's low vol or value or whatever. But the fact is performance certainly makes a difference here in terms of flows. Drew, you mentioned about maybe not fully capturing the upside, and I do think it's important to point that out because while these ETFs can hold up better in a downturn like we saw in the fourth quarter, they are likely to trail in an up market. You don't usually get to have your cake and eat it too with these ETFs. I think the goal here is to provide a smoother ride overall. And also, I think it's important to point out, you were talking earlier about the flows into fixed income. These are not bond substitutes in a portfolio, right? Sometimes investors get lulled into thinking low vol or even high dividend ETFs are somewhat equivalent to bonds, but there is real risk here. There's stock market risk. I guess on that note, anytime we get a rush of money into low vol stocks or really any area of the market, inevitably there's talk of overextended valuations, right? Just that you have everyone piling into the same area. Do you think that's a concern here with low vol ETFs?
I think it's a reflection of the market. I think that's what people are doing, either buying it through an ETF, individual stocks, active manage. I think that's the market has just moved there. I don't think these two ETFs are becoming the trigger for overvaluation. They may reflect that overvaluation, as you just announced, you know, just stated the performance of these low vol funds have been outperforming. That will not last, right? At some point, that just doesn't make any sense for it to continue to outperform over the next 5 years. I'd be stunned. So I think it's more of a reflection of just where the market's moving. And obviously, when you look at the overall, again, the big picture, $42 billion into fixed income and $13 billion into equities, that's a real unbalance we haven't seen in a while that's persisting.
Well, something else I think is important, too, just when you talk about, you know, potential extended valuations in this space. If you look at something like SPLV, again, that owns the 100 least volatile stocks in the S&P 500. But there's a quarterly rebalance, right? So theoretically, if some stocks start running ahead, perhaps volatility increases, they're going to continually rebalance every quarter into the least 100 volatile stocks. I have to ask you, there's a new ETF in this space. It's called the SALT Low True Beta U.S. Market ETF, ticker LSLT. Yep. And what's noteworthy about this ETF is that it pays you to own it, right? It has a negative fee after a fee waiver. Do you think this can get some traction, just given all the interest in low vol, and then you add in this negative fee?
Yeah, it's a little different animal. I mean, it does go low vol, but it also has a beta component to it. But yeah, I mean, that it being free or it pays you, I don't know what it ends up being. A little gimmicky, but if that's the, you know, the bait that attracts some eyeballs into the fund, more power to them. It's a SALT Financial's a new ETF issuer. It's small. They're trying to get some attention, and it's very, very difficult for a new ETF issuer to come in into a space where there's $28 billion that you're competing against in assets just from two funds, right? So the liquidity and size is where the institutional fish will go. But it is an interesting fund, and time will tell. Also keep in mind total cost. It does have a spread of 21 basis points. So in terms of getting in, there is a cost. Whereas SPY, the biggest ETF in the world, is at one basis point. spread. So there's all those factors to consider. And all three of these ETFs we've talked about have different components. So it is important for investors not to just go to the expense ratio, but go to underneath the hood and understand what you're buying, because these are a lot different in some ways. However, with USMV and SPLV, I will point out, despite the rebalancing and USMV having 200 constituents and SPLV having 100, there is an overlap of some 75% of SPLV's holdings in USMV. So the distinction between the two, I think it really comes down to a very sophisticated investor understanding that. If you have been seeing the headlines and you're in a retail investor and you're like, well, Vol, that kind of sounds like a good idea. I don't think the differences are much. I would stay with these two because they're big, they're liquid. But if you're a sophisticated investor and you understand what you're getting with LSLT, and you like the expense ratio and you like their approach, which is different because it focuses on beta and volatility of beta, which is a little different than these other two. So there's a lot of choices out there. And then, as I said, there's 20 some other low-vol ETFs, as they're called, but they all sometimes perform differently. It's not like a vanilla S&P 500 fund that, you know, whether it's MSCI or S&P, they're basically covering the S&P 5.
No, I think those are all great points. And if you look at LSLT, right now it has about $5 million in assets. But AUM's not always everything, right? This is holding stocks from 1,000 of the largest U.S.-listed companies. So obviously there is liquidity there. I think the negative fee on this is, I think, part of the rationale there is to compensate investors because maybe the bid-ask spread is a little bit higher. So the transaction costs there are a little bit greater. But, Drew, excellent perspective on low-vol this week. As always, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
That was ETF.com's Drew Voris. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, I'm really excited for our next guest. We're going to be joined by Acquires Funds Tobias Carlyle. We'll discuss his brand new deep value ETF that's just launched in May, and we'll also talk value investing in general. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate Geraci alongside Connor Kelly. And we're now very excited to be joined by Tobias Carlyle, founder and managing director of Acquires Funds, who recently launched their first ETF. It's appropriately called the Acquires Fund. The ticker symbol is ZIG, Z-I-G. And underlying this ETF is something called the Acquires Multiple, which Tobias actually created and wrote a book on. And by the way, he's also written three other books, Concentrated Investing, Deep Value, and Quantitative Value. And to top it all off, he has a legal background as well. He was a mergers and acquisitions lawyer. Tobias is on the line with us from Los Angeles. Tobias, great to finally have you on ETF Prime. Thanks for joining us.
What a great introduction. Thanks for having me, gents.
All right, so we have to start with your background here. How in the world did you go from practicing law to launching an ETF?
Well, I had always enjoyed value investing. I'd read security analysis when I was studying at law school, and I worked in an area of law that's pretty close to, so I worked in mergers and acquisitions, and the time when I started working was the early 2000s, so there was a lot of activism, and there was a lot of private equity, and so those two informed the way that I invested, because I could see these guys doing a lot of work to take a company private, paying a premium to do that. And then at the same time, I could see a comparable company listed on the stock exchange. It's so much easier to buy it when it's publicly listed. And I could see that you could buy it for a cheaper price. And I thought, if these guys think that this thing is going to work privately, paying a higher premium, then I'm sure it's going to work publicly, paying less for it.
Okay, so on that note, before we get to the ETF itself, you wrote a book called The Acquires Multiple. Explain for us what The Acquires Multiple is.
So the acquirer's multiple is a ratio that looks at companies, businesses, and values them in the same way that activists and private equity firms do. So you might be familiar with the price to earnings ratio, which looks at literally the bottom line profitability of a company and then compares that to the market capitalization. But what it misses is how much debt the company's carrying, whether it's got some cash on its balance sheet, whether it's got preferred stock, and a variety of other things that are real cost to an acquirer of the company. So we include those into our analysis, and then we look at a metric that's operating income that's a little bit different from bottom line profitability. And the idea is that it adjusts for interest payments and tax, and it looks at the accounting measure of cash flow that goes into the company.
Okay, so that brings us to the acquirers fund. Again, ticker symbol ZIG, ZIG. This is a long-short strategy, and the ETF uses this acquirers multiple to identify deeply undervalued companies who are potentially strong targets for activist and buyout firms. Then it shorts what are believed to be overvalued companies. Take us from there. Explain the details. Explain the investment process.
So shorting is not just the opposite of going long, because a lot of these companies, I can't even come up with a valuation for them. So it's not to say that they're overvalued, it's just to say that it's impossible to value them, because typically they're losing money, they're burning cash, they have a lot of debt, they have an interesting story, which is what everybody has latched onto. So Tesla was one for a long time that was in the screen, but it's no longer in there. And we've looked at other things that are software, internet type businesses where really, the way that they're surviving is they're issuing stock and they're using that to keep themselves afloat in the hope that at some stage the business will start making money. And we're looking at them at the time that they seem to be running out of money. They've got a lot of debt. Something special needs to happen. And the market has also woken up to it because the stock has no momentum. So what I mean by that is the stock is basically not up over the last 12 months, which I think indicates that the market's getting a little bit tired of the story. And something is about to happen to the stock. So we buy it short at that stage, looking forward to the next quarter and hoping that something happens in that quarter.
What is the universe of stocks that you pull from, and then how many holdings are in this ETF?
It's the top 1,500. So it's comparable to, say, the S&P 1500, which is a composite index. But that's about it targets this mid to small part of the market where there's still active professional private equity and active activists. And we also think that the companies have enough heft to survive. So if anything happens on the long side, they've got professional management and they've got reasonably strong, robust, national-sized businesses. And in the portfolio, we have 30 stocks long, and we weight them a little bit. We weight them 4.33%. We're aiming for that at inception. So that's 130% long. And then we short them all to 1% short. So there's 30 shorts to 1% short.
So as you alluded to, this is a 130-30 long short strategy. For investors not familiar with this, can you explain the benefits of this approach and perhaps what the risk return profile looks like compared to just going 100% long?
Sure. So the net long is 100% long. So you can think of it as two portfolios. One is just a net long value investing, deep value portfolio, and then there's another market neutral 30-30 portfolio attached to it. What we're trying to capture with the 30-30 long short part of the portfolio is there's a spread between the most overvalued and the most undervalued stocks, and that tends to close over time. So each time we rebalance, we're trying to capture that spread closing as the undervalued stocks get a little bit more pricey and the expensive stocks come back down to earth. And then on the long side, that 100% long, all we're trying to do is capture the long-term outperformance of value stocks. Although it's been a rough sort of 5 years for value, everybody may be aware that value stocks have tended to underperform because it's been a very frothy market. But that's unusual. If we look at the data going back, we can go back to the 1920s, we can go back to the 1950s, and we can see that historically value has tended to do a little bit better. You get a value premium that outperforms the market.
Is there anything done to ensure diversification across sectors, or do you simply go with the companies you believe to be most undervalued or I guess pricey if you're shorting, wherever those may be?
So I have a view that stocks tend to get cheap in an industry at the same time. And if you limit your exposure to any given industry, then you're limiting your potential upside performance. So we don't do that. And what that means is that we tend to be concentrated in whatever is the most undervalued sector at the time. So, for example, right now it's financials. Financials are historically cheap, and they're cheap relative to every other sector in the on the market. So we have a concentration. We're about 50% financials right now.
Tobias, this is an index-based ETF, and as I understand it, you're looking at financial statements for statistical measures of fraud, earnings manipulation, financial distress. How do you go from sort of that forensic evaluation of company financial statements in considering valuations to the actual index itself?
We construct the index in-house. That's sort of where the brains, the know-how, and the IP is. And so we have models that pull out the stock names that we'd like to be invested in, and then we have a final step where we run this forensic accounting analysis just to make sure that there's nothing in the financial statements that fools the model. So sometimes you might have an unusual financial statement. Insurers typically have unusual financial statements because often their liabilities are carried off balance sheet. They're not easy to be included, and that might suggest to the model that they look cheaper than they actually are. So we run this analysis just to make sure that the economic reality is reflected in the financial statements. And if it is, then we buy them. The reason we do it as an index product is that has some very substantial tax benefits over running it as an active fund. From our perspective, there's not much difference between running it actively or running it passively. But if we run it passively, then we get these capital gains tax advantages.
Our guest is Tobias Carlisle, founder and managing director of Acquirers Funds. They recently launched a new ETF, the Acquirers Fund, ticker symbol ZIG. Tobias, as I know you're well aware, the value ETF space is extremely crowded. And of course, look, the ETFs run a spectrum here, right? There's everything from really watered down value ETFs based on price to book to highly concentrated value ETFs using other value metrics. Can you talk about where ZIG fits and how you're attempting to differentiate here?
Right. So we say that there's a big difference between value as a factor and value as a philosophy. So value as a factor is the academic quantitative approach to value. And I might use price to book, say, for example, as one of the main metrics. And that's what some of the bigger indexes do, where they might hold 1,000 stocks or several thousand stocks. And what's going to happen with those indexes is that they're going to be tied to the performance of that factor, and they tend to give, as you say, fairly watered-down performance, but they do tend to track the main index, the S&P 500 or the Russell 1000 or whatever the case may be, pretty closely. And so they don't underperform much, but they don't outperform much either. What we try to do is we try to find companies that are genuinely undervalued, deeply undervalued, and the result of that will be that they'll give this wide tracking error. So what that means is that the path that they're going to take is going to be wildly divergent from the path of the broader indexes. Now, that means sometimes it's going to underperform, and that's certainly what's happened over the last 5 years. But we think that we've reached this point in the market where the spread between the most overvalued and the most undervalued is so wide that if you start betting now on value, there's a good chance that that tracking error outperforms to the upside.
Given that wide tracking error, do you view ZIG as a core position in a portfolio, and it's really then just making sure an investor's educated on what type of ride to expect?
Right. Well, so what we say is that that's certainly a possibility for people to take, but we say that the fund gives you this very concentrated exposure to the value factor. So you don't need to put a big part of your portfolio in. We say it's capital efficient. You can put a small portion of your portfolio into it, and you get all of that outsized exposure to value. And then you can put in whatever else you like for the vast majority of your exposure. So you might like VT, which is the Vanguard Total Market, or something else like that that'll give you the low-cost market kind of performance. And then we'll give you the very specialized, concentrated exposure to value.
You mentioned it's been a rough 5 years for a value. I think just about everyone is pretty well aware that growth has crushed value in terms of performance. Two questions here. Why do you think that is? And then you began to touch on this a bit earlier, but what, if anything, does that mean moving forward?
You know, these things, these cycles happen on a regular basis in the market. Everybody remembers the dot-com boom. Value underperformed pretty substantially then. Same thing happened at the very tail end of the 2007 boom. When the markets get speculative, and you can see Beyond Meat, BYND, which folks might know about, it's not meat. But the stock has a roughly $10 or $11 billion valuation. It loses about $60 million a year. There's some fierce competition in that area, and yet the stock is up 10 or 12% most days, and that is going to go on until it stops and it turns around. Why it stops, I don't know. I think folks just get tired of the speculative nature of the stock. When that happens, they're probably going to go looking for solid balance sheets, free cash flow, stock being bought back, and that's what we provide.
But what do you think is driving that growth outperformance over the past 5 years?
I think it could be, you know, interest rates set at a too low level, very accommodative Fed policy. It's a combination of just animal spirits on the one hand, and that often seems to coincide with interest rates being set too low.
Yeah, and by the way, I have to mention, so on Twitter last week, Jake, so EconomPick, he ran two great polls. One asked, what is the most likely reason growth stocks have outperformed value stocks over the last 1, 3, 5, 10, and 15 years? And then the other asked, what is the least likely reason? And the answer to both of those polls was the Fed. I just thought that was classic. Tobias, I guess playing devil's advocate, if the last time value spreads were this wide, you know, you go back to the dot-com crash and perhaps the financial crisis, shouldn't investors be reducing risk overall? I mean, even if value outperforms growth, isn't there a chance investors get bludgeoned anyway?
Well, you may recall in the early 2000s, it was an unusual period in the market where the market was falling, but value stocks were going up and outperforming, and a lot of value investors made their names through that period. But that's because it followed a period in the late 1990s where value underperformed horribly while the market was very strong. And even as vaunted a value name as Warren Buffett, there were magazine covers saying, has Warren lost his touch? And you can certainly see comparable newspaper magazine covers right now talking about the death of value investing. And so I love seeing those because I'm a contrarian, mean reverting guy, and I think that means that something good's about to happen.
Well, how much of that do you think is really based on this whole discussion around what value really is, right? What's the right metric to use here? And obviously, you probably think your metric is the best, but what are your thoughts on measures like price to book? Do you think the wrong metrics are contributing to this discussion around value being dead?
Yeah, but price to book certainly has. There are two issues with price to book, and one is cyclical, and one is secular. The cyclical one is just the underperformance of value. Folks don't want stuff that is boring and old economy. The secular one, there are some problems with the accounting treatment. It's a technical discussion, but there are some problems with the accounting treatment. Some of these companies have bought back so much stock, they have negative equity, and they're still very good companies throwing off an enormous amount of cash, but price to book just can't classify them properly as being value stocks. So there are problems with price to book. I prefer flow measures. So what I mean by that is I prefer cash flow to enterprise value or earnings to enterprise value or the acquirer's multiple, which is an earnings cash flow type metric, because it doesn't really matter what the nature of the economy is, whether it's a heavy asset intensive business or it's a sort of more dot-com-y type business. Ultimately, the success or failure of that business is demonstrated in how much money it makes. And as a value investor, I want to pay as little as I possibly can for that. And the questions about value investing often come at the end of the bull market when value investing has been underperforming. And those questions are always, they look at it and they say, well, if you had a little bit more growth in your portfolio, you'd have done a little bit better. And so the more growth you have in your portfolio, the better you've done. But as a mean reverting guy, I've seen that argument a few times before, and I think that what happens is that's an argument that only happens at the end of the bull market, and we have a crash, value have a very good run, and then we'll go back to being old school value investors again.
Tobias, this is Connor Kelly. Going back to the short side of the portfolio here for a minute, that's not something that gets discussed too often on our show. You mentioned, you know, Beyond Meat, right? And a couple other recent IPOs, right, with Uber and Lyft, these companies that are losing money, yet their stock prices continue to climb. And obviously, you're not going to short a company, like you said, without some breakdown in the momentum of that stock. But just for our listeners and our own interest, could you maybe list one or two of the perhaps more interesting shorts you guys have right now in the fund?
Sure. So the one that I've discussed publicly on a number of occasions is Grubhub. Now, Grubhub is a company that has a price earnings ratio above 100. I think it's in the 130. So you're paying an enormous amount of money for the underlying business. It doesn't really matter how good that business is. That's probably too much money to pay. But you can walk into any restaurant now and you can see that they have half a dozen iPads that all connect them to different services. And I know in my family, when we order food, we go and we find the cheapest way to buy whatever food we want delivered. So Grubhub is a company that it's not making much money at the moment. It's way too expensive and there's fierce competition. I think when you get those things together, particularly when the stock price has languished for 12 months, that's often an indication that that the stock is overpriced and there's going to be a little bit of downside momentum there, and we're going to try to capture that. But we're always rebalancing that short portfolio on a regular basis. And the reason that we do that is that shorting is a sort of dark art more than it's a science, and we're looking for stocks that are typically losing money, burning cash, heavily indebted, issuing stock to stay alive, raising debt to stay alive, and no momentum, but still the stock price is wildly divergent from the underlying reality of the company. So another one that we had in our models was Tesla. Well, that's now out of our portfolio, but it was one that was in there for a long time. And the reason that that's out, even though a lot of the other criteria are still met, it's out because it's become too heavily shorted. And we tend to exit at that stage because the fortunes of the performance of that stock are now tied to what the shorts do. So the shorts can get spooked like anybody else, and that can create short squeezes and funny things happen in the stock. So one of our own risk metrics is just to exit when they become too heavily shorted. So it was still down roughly 50% over our holding period. But when it came time to form the portfolio for the ETF about a month ago, we took it out because it was too heavily shorted.
Tobias, we have just a couple of minutes left. Going back to the launch of your ETF, I know you and I visited about this down at the Inside ETFs conference earlier this year, but I was hoping you might be willing to share with our listeners. Look, you're an entrepreneur. You came up with this idea. You know how brutal the ETF business is, right? There's pressure on fees. Good ideas can be ripped off by larger issuers. You have to get distribution, right? You have to get past the gatekeepers at wirehouses and in larger firms. What made you look at all that and still decide you want to be in the ETF business?
Well, I think that there's nothing out there like ZIG. That long, short, deep value is unusual to unique. I don't want to say it's unique because there are comparable funds out there. But I think that the performance of value has been so bad for so long. And being a mean reverting guy, I think that what happens is that value tends to outperform over periods of bad performance. And I think that I'm reasonably well known on Twitter at least, and I've written a number of books that explain the philosophy about what I'm trying to do pretty clearly. So I think that I'm a sort of known quantity. The investment strategy is a known strategy. We're going to implement it the way that I think that it should be done, and I think we're going to get some good performance. And I think when all of those things come together, that tends to be something that folks can get behind with some comfort, and they'll know what we're going to do. They'll know how we're going to perform, and they're going to know the reasons why we do it. And I think that that's a pretty compelling pitch.
Well, Tobias, really glad we could finally connect. Congratulations on the ETF. We'll certainly be cheering for your success. Thank you for joining us this week.
Thanks, Nate. Thanks, Connor. It was a real pleasure.
That was Tobias Carlisle, founder and managing director of Acquirers Funds. And you can learn more about ZIG by visiting acquirersfund.com. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll spotlight the VolShares Large Cap ETF. We'll be joined by Dom Catrambone, CEO of Whitford Asset Management. This is ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Our next guest is Dom Catrambone, CEO of Whitford Asset Management. They're behind the VolShares Large Cap ETF, ticker symbol VSL, which is what we'll be spotlighting this week. Dom is joining us via phone from Philadelphia. Dom, a pleasure having you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Dom, let's just jump right in here. We were actually talking low volatility ETFs earlier with ETF.com's Drew Voris. My understanding is this ETF sort of fits into that bucket. So explain for us what this ETF is designed to do and perhaps the basic investment process.
Sure. Well, what we do is we employ a volatility-based algorithm that indicates market sentiment and forward-looking short-term price movement when applied to individual stocks, such as when we apply it to all the companies inside the S&P 500. We then rebalance it on a weekly basis and use 25 stocks as the stocks that we invest in. And we do this to make sure that we are on top of volatility as much as we can and as tight as we can. And when we employ our strategy, we concentrate on the lower volatility stocks.
So is the goal of this ETF to seek out performance? Is it to minimize volatility, get higher risk-adjusted returns? What's the end goal?
Great question. And, well, twofold. Is first and foremost is to manage volatility. While we're doing that, we want to maximize our return as much as possible.
Now, you mentioned market sentiment. Can you explain that piece in a little more detail? How exactly are you determining that?
Sure. Well, when we do this on a weekly basis, because of the way we calculate coming up with our weekly picks, what it seems to be doing, our model, is tracking where the momentum is for each week. So in doing that, we're seeing where institutional investors, large investors, hedge funds, the general public is wanting to be for the upcoming week for various reasons, such as today. Today would be a very good example. We're in our last day of the trade because we trade Wednesday to Wednesday, and we look to get our positions Tuesday close to Tuesday close. As you know, Fed is meeting today, first of the two-day meeting, and we are overweighted in financials. With the comments that came out earlier today, with things that are happening with President Trump and his comments, our financials are averaging at least 2.5% and above for each one of our positions.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you, given the market conditions we've seen recently and really over the past year, how has this ETF performed relative to other large cap ETFs out there, perhaps some of the low volatility ETFs?
Well, given this year to date, and as per ETF.com, we are up roughly 29.53%, making us number one in our category, and we've been number one year to date for at least the last three quarters. We have a spread, meaning how far ahead the S&P 500 and let's call it the SPY for what tracks the S&P 500, and we're roughly about 12.5% spread to their year-to-date number. So we're having a very good year this year.
I'm curious, where did the idea for this ETF come from?
Well, what in my career, I worked for a company that invested in alternative assets, if you will, and we ran hedge funds and separate managed accounts and other type of institutional products. What I've noticed was when we had a consistent type of program, and we did have one that actually was in the high yield space, it may have not have gotten what the market returns have gotten, meaning in the equity in the S&P 500. So let's say in a given year it may have gotten 6 or 8% and the market did 12 to 15%. Well, it consistently did that, though, year in, year out, and no one really left the program. But in our more aggressive equity positions, if we had a negative 20% or let's just call it some type of pain, you saw money coming in and out. So I always said that I wanted to develop a product that mimicked those type of consistent returns but still stayed in the equity market. So I just worked on this product for a good 10 years plus, and this is the result of it.
Our guest is Dom Catcher-Rambone, CEO of Whitford Asset Management. They're behind the BallShares Large Cap ETF, ticker symbol VSO. Dom, if you don't mind, I did want to ask you about closure risk here, because it was reported earlier in the year that this ETF would actually close up shop. Now, since then, I believe you had a larger investor come on board, and so the ETF currently has about $1.5 million invested. Do you mind just briefly speaking to this?
No, not at all. Yes, even though we have great returns and we have a very solid product, in our first year, we faced a lot of challenges similar to other startup ETF funds in attracting capital and raising capital and keeping capital here to run the business. We were able to find a investor group that felt very strong in our methodology, very strong in our future. And because this product not only works for the S&P 500, but it can be applied to other indices, whether they're domestic or international. So we now have a nice, strong investor base to build for the future, and we're here to stay.
And Dom, on this note, and I actually asked our previous guest a similar question, but can you talk about the difficulty of gaining traction in the ETF space? So I think it's been well documented how competitive it is, right? But from your perspective, what do you see as some of the biggest challenges?
Yes, and we see them, and I don't mean to harp on how good our performance is, but it correlates to this question exactly. So right now we're the number one fund, and we've been the number one fund for a long time. But being the number one fund, we only have two creation units, $1.5 million out there. The environment is not only competitive but very tough, because when you're starting out, you don't come from an institution and you can't have money that just goes into the fund and puts you at a certain level, such as it seems a magic number in the marketplace nowadays is $50 million. And if you don't have that $50 million, there's several people that still want to sit in the back and wait till you get to that point. And it becomes frustrating, because in the ETF space, you deal with market makers and you deal with creation units. And why I say that is because at any time, someone who believes in you can invest in you today and take their own money out tomorrow, whether they do it through the secondary market or directly with the market maker. So this $50 million, whatever you want to put it out there, is a challenge, and I personally feel it should be a level that shouldn't be out there because of the 100% liquidity that you can get with an ETF.
Well, and not only that, in your ETF, you're holding 25 large cap U.S. companies from the S&P 500. So at the end of the day, the liquidity's there. AUM, you know, doesn't necessarily matter. Again, I do think it maybe comes back to potential closure risk. But what about just these gatekeepers at wirehouses and larger RIA firms? Have you run into challenges there?
And yes, and in all fairness, you know, maybe a stipulation should be in place for other products not like mine that aren't as liquid as a large cap stock. But because of this certain types of AUM under management, I have run into where the trades have to happen on a one-off. They can't just happen unilaterally through a wirehouse. But we're not letting that stop us. We're not letting that hold us back. We believe we'll be at $50 million in a short period of time, and then all of a sudden it should be a snowball effect.
Well, and on that note, we have about a minute left. What do you see as the future of ETFs here for Whitford?
Well, I see us streamlining with what we have now with the S&P 500. We have already beta tested and started implementing a new product called the CSI 300, which has gotten great back-tested returns. We hope to come out with some type of product on that, and then come out with each one of the popular indexes, such as NASDAQ, MidCap, et cetera, using our methodology.
Well, Dom, really enjoyed the conversation this week. We certainly wish you the best. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Dom Catcher-Rambone, CEO of Whitford Asset Management. And you can learn more about the VolShares Large Cap ETF by visiting VolSharesETFs.com/VSL. That's VolSharesETFs.com/VSL. That'll do it for this week's show. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit LeggMason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at ETFPrime.com, ETF.com, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. You can follow me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci. Next week, two really interesting guests. We'll first be joined by Mike Akins, founding partner at ETF Action. So they offer an innovative new ETF research platform. And Mike is an ETF industry veteran, so we'll talk about that platform. And then I'm going to hit Mike with our rapid-fire ETF Q&A. And then Nancy Davis, Chief Investment Officer at Quadratic Capital, is going to spotlight the recently launched Quadratic Interest Rate Volatility Inflation Hedge ETF. Until then, have a great week, everyone.